Blog Talk Radio.
All right. Good evening, everybody, and welcome to Golf Talk Live. I'm your host, Ted Oderico. Welcome back. I took a little vacation last week in honor of Mother's Day and wanted to spend time with my mother, who's been up in the hospital for the last several weeks, recovering nicely, thank you, but nevertheless, thought I needed to spend a little time with her. So get well soon, Mom, and we look forward to see you getting back out there and enjoying your days. But anyways, welcome again to Golf Talk Live. And tonight we've got another great group of professionals on here on Coach's Corner. And we're going to get to those guys in just a minute here. But I want to remind everybody, of course, that we're live on blogtalkradio.com for the next couple of hours from 6 Central Time to 8 p.m. And after we're done, of course, the Coach's Corner, I'm going to be joined later in the show. I'm going to interview Greg Jones, the Academy Director of Natural Swing Trainer. He's going to come on and talk a little bit about some of the features and some of the benefits that not only golfers can get from the Natural Swing, but also fellow teaching pros. So he's going to come on and talk about that in about an hour's time. In the meantime, as I said, we're live here on blogtalkradio.com. If you want to tune into the program live, you can do so by either going directly to this link at www.blogtalkradio.com/golftalklive, or you can just go to blogtalkradio.com and up in the search key, you can just type in Golf Talk Live. As I said, we're live from 6 to 8 p.m. Central Time. If you want to speak to anybody on the program during the live broadcast, you can do so by calling in at area code 646-716-4667, or you can email me anytime at ted.golftalklive@gmail.com. If you've got some questions or comments about the program, or if you're somebody in the golf industry and you're interested in coming on to the show, you can certainly get in touch with me that way. Also, don't forget to get updates for the show on a variety of social media. You can visit the Facebook page at facebook.com/golftalkliveblog, and while you're there, make sure you throw a few likes my way. I'd certainly appreciate it. And, of course, for those of you that follow me on Twitter, you can do so at Ted and Buck CEO, and that's CEO in caps. I appreciate all of the recent followers in the last few weeks that have joined in and followed me on Twitter. So thanks, guys, for doing that. And also, don't forget to check out the Golf Talk Live blog website at www.golftalkliveblog.com. Okay, let me introduce the panel, and I'll bring them out here, and we'll get going on Coach's Corner. Newcomer to the panel tonight is a gentleman actually I interviewed during the PGA show this past January, Michael Wheeler. He's the PGA Director of Instruction up at the Bellwood Golf and Country Club up in Pottstown, Pennsylvania. And he's joining us for the first time tonight. And, of course, one of our returning panelists, Brad Redding, PGA Master Teaching Professional and the Director of Instruction at the Members Club at Grand Dunes in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. And he's also the owner-operator of Brad Redding Golf. Gentlemen, welcome to Coach's Corner.
Ted, great thanks to have you. To be here. Thanks.
Not a problem. And thanks for sitting tight and letting me get through all that stuff. It's a lot to get through at the beginning of the program, but I want to make sure everybody has that information. As I said, obviously, we were talking just a few minutes ago off air here. And, of course, Michael's new to the panel. He's came on the show back in January. I think it was on the Thursday night, of course, of the PGA show. And actually had a chance to meet face-to-face for a few minutes during the show, and he came on and did an interview then and wanted to participate in Coach's Corner. So, Michael, particularly thank you for joining in on the panel. And, Brad, of course, welcome back, and looking forward to some great input from both of you tonight. And unfortunately, we had a third panelist that had to back out last minute, Nancy Corsolino, but she is going to be joining us in a future segment of Coach's Corner, and sorry we're going to miss her tonight, but Nancy, thanks for giving me the heads up. Okay, guys, let me just very quickly, before we get into the first question tonight, Let me just remind everybody that's tuning in very quickly what Coach's Corner is about. Each week, of course, you, meaning the golfers out there, have an opportunity to send your email questions into the program and pick the brains of some of the best coaches and teaching pros in the business. I'll have a different panel, of course, every week, and we'll cover a new topic, plus help some of you weekend warriors out there as well. And here's essentially how the segment will work. I'll pose some of the questions to the panel. Of course, we'll start the discussion and then rotate around to each of the members for some general comments and then open the floor for any additional comments if there is any. So this is your opportunity, guys, out there to participate in the discussion. You can either call in at any time if you want during the live broadcast from 6 to 7 p.m. Central Time. And the number to call is, again, 646-716-4667. Or you can email your questions to questions.golftalklive@gmail.com. Okay, we're ready to start, guys. I gave you guys the heads up on tonight's topic, and it was one that I did a couple of weeks ago, and I just thought it was worth doing again here. So, guys, here it is, and Brad, I'm, of course, as mentioned off air, I'm going to start with you. As a teaching professional, what have you learned from your students? And this was a question that was put in by Mark from Scottsdale, Arizona, and he writes into the program and says, as teaching professionals, you come across all types of students, from the beginning golfer to the more advanced, and after years of teaching golfers of all ages and abilities, what, if anything, do you feel you've learned from your students? Brad?
Well, I think that, you know, we all learn something new and different from our students. I mean, to get a better chance to know them and understand them, that's probably the biggest thing for me is to go much more in-depth in terms of not just knowing them, you know, them as a golfer, but knowing more about them as a person, too. And some things I've learned from my students as far as things that have helped me in my teaching is that the more I ask them questions about their life in terms of children, business, you know, married, you know, girlfriends, things of that nature, I get to know them better that way, and they become more of a client. They become more of a friend. And I think that's
right.
An important thing to establish with your students, that connection with your students to understand more about them. And so the more they offer information to me about their lives, the better I am able to help them, because now it goes much more beyond a student relationship. It goes more into a friend relationship, and I count most of my students as friends. And so
right.
You know, if I see them, you know, during the day, or if I see them out in the evening, you know, we can actually, you know, talk and converse. So that's probably the biggest thing I've learned from my students is that they want to be more than just my student. They want to be my friend.
Right. Right. And that's a really great point, Brad, because, you know, you have to, I think, to be an effective teacher or coach or guru, whatever, you know, you have to be somebody that earns trust in anything that you do. When you're teaching, whether you're a teacher at a school or what have you, you have to have that sort of trust between student and teacher. And I think as golf professionals, I think that's really sort of the first line, you know, before we even get into the lesson, is really an establishing a rapport. You know, not everybody's going to gel, and sometimes personalities are going to conflict a little bit. So, you know, that's a great opportunity right from a very, you know, early stages of instruction with a student is building that line of trust and forming friendships, because I think as time goes on, once those bonds sort of develop, it then becomes easier as an instructor to be able to relay the information when you have some information in return other than just how they're swinging and what they want to fix. So I think
absolutely,
a personal relationship is a great idea. Michael, what about yourself? If anything, have you learned from some of the students you've worked with?
I mean, I've learned so much. I've learned a lot more from my students than I feel like that they've learned from me. You know, I think Brad hit the nail on the head. You got to create a relationship with your student. You know, it all comes down to trust, like you said. But, you know, besides that, I think one of the biggest things that I've learned from my students that I'm always trying to implement, not only in my teaching but in my life, is patience. You know, how many times do we get a student that, you know, we're trying to work with them on something in the golf swing, changing motion, changing the thought process, whatever it is. Some students get it right away. Other students, it takes a couple lessons before they get it. But, you know,
right.
But understanding them as a person, understanding them as a human being, and and understanding how they learn, you know, and just understanding that, you know, patience goes a long way. I was watching Mike Adams teach last week, and, you know, one student got it right away. The other student, the very next lesson, they were working on a very similar thing, a little different lesson, obviously, but working on something very similar, and it took almost the entire lesson before the student got it. And we talked about it afterwards, and the thing he said to me is, you just got to be patient. You know, let them learn it. They'll pick it up when their mind has to process through the information sometimes. And it's just understanding that, you know, you just got to say the right thing at the right time and understand, you know, you got to know how to say the same thing a bunch of different ways. But being patient, if you're not patient, you're just going to rush through it and they may not get it. You know, but I think being patient is very important.
Right. And that adds to, you know, if as an instructor, if you don't have that level of patience and try to sort of rush through the lesson, what ultimately ends up happening, as you said, especially when you've got multiple students, you might have to do that get it right away, and you might have somebody. Everybody learns differently. For instance, myself as an example, I'm more of a visual learner. I like to learn by seeing examples of things, and some people, can learn that way, and others don't. Others, you know, you can simply say a few words and they can pick it up right away. Others need to kind of see what you're talking about. And that's kind of how I've always sort of learned, throughout my process. But if you don't have that level of patience, what often ends up happening, I think, is as a teacher professional, if the student isn't able to retain the information as quickly as maybe somebody else, more often than not, they become frustrated and more than likely will end up dropping out at some point because they're not getting it or not understanding it. And it's not just dropping out from lessons, but actually dropping out of the game. And I think this has been something that's gone on for quite some time, and I think a lot of the teaching pros have recognized this, of course, but I think sometimes we need to take a step back and remember that everybody doesn't learn at the same speed or during the same process. So we have to remember to be patient as instructors and let those students, receive that information that we're giving them at their pace. And if they need to, have a little bit further instruction, we need to encourage them to ask questions if they're unclear or unsure of something in order to open up that dialogue. But great answer, guys, and great way to start off the panel discussion tonight. Let me move into, and unless we have anything else, either one of you want to add to that, or I think we pretty much covered it.
Yeah, I mean, pretty much it's just, you know, letting them know that you care about them, and when you care about them, I mean, I learned this from Hank Haney. Hank, a good friend, and he said, Brad, he says, no one cares how much you know until they know how much you care, and he didn't make that into the quote, but he told me that, and he says, you know, they don't care how much you know, they want to know how much you care, and going along with my point, I mean, you know, to be patient, you've got to really care about what you're doing and to care about them, and I think that's a great point.
Yeah, and that's another excellent point, because I think, you know, students, it's like anything, it's in business in general. I think if the consumer feels like you have a genuine interest either in their well-being or in whether it be a product or service that you're providing, if they sense that there's genuine concern and well-being, they're going to be more receptive. If they feel that they're just another number or another cog in a wheel, so to speak, then they're not going to be as likely to want to continue on working with you as an instructor. So, you know, building those relationships and, as you said, letting the students know that it's not how much we know, but, you know, that we care about them and wanting to see them succeed in whatever level they want to take their game. And certainly number one thing is we want them to enjoy their experience when they're with us. So, again, great answers, guys. And I'm going to move on to the first email question here for tonight. And this is from Roger from San Antonio, Texas. His email starts off with, my question tonight revolves around the short game. Here's my scenario. I sometimes hit my approach shot short and find myself in that 20 to 30 yard short of the green. Our course, of course, mows the grass very short in front of the green. Therefore, I find myself hitting off quite often off a tight lie. I'm left with a short pitch and not sure what club I should use. I find myself hitting it thin quite often. My question, what am I doing wrong? Michael, I'm going to start with you, if that's okay, on this question here. Generally, the scenario here is he's obviously hitting it short of the green. We want to obviously encourage him to hit the green, but for those guys that do hit a little short and they're on hitting from a tight lie, you know, in that 20 to 30-yard range, what are some suggestions on how we can handle that shot a little bit easier?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a couple ways you can look at it. I mean, if you're 20, 30 yards short of the green, if there's no bunkers or anything in front of you, one alternative that you can always do is take a 7-iron and play it back in your stance and kind of hit like a little bump and run up into the green. It's a very easy, very high percentage shot. Now, if you want to hit the pitch shot, a lot of it determines around the turf conditions. If it's firm, you know, you don't want to wedge with a lot of bounce. And if you do, you know, there's going to be a tendency the club could either, if you hit a little behind, it could bounce up into and belly the ball a little bit, and you're hitting it a little thin that way. Or you just, you know, or it could just be, it sounds to me like you might be just a little bit fearful of the shot, and it could be more of a mental issue than anything.
Yep.
But I think if he just practices the shot, go up to the shot, make a couple practice swings right next to the ball. I use the you know, for most players, I use a clock system that Ted Shestick taught me. You know, a 20-yard shot, you want to take your hands back to about 8 o'clock and turn the body through to your hands are about 4 o'clock. The most important thing with that shot is you have to accelerate. But if you're fearful of the shot and the outcome that you're going to get, like blading the ball, there's a very good chance that you could decelerate on it, or, you know, just be anxious to look at the ball and hit it thin. But just focus on making good practice swings, taking the hands back to 8, turning the body through to 4, to the hands are at 4, and just accelerate through the shot. Just when you're making your practice strokes, just brush the grass just over and over again. Where that club's entering the ground, just put the ball just behind that, and then do the same thing over the golf ball. Just be confident. You know, those shots are more about confidence and hit. You know, just knowing that you're going to hit ball then turf. Once you hit a few of those shots really well, I think that will take a lot of the confidence and turn it over again. But, I always, with those 20, 30-yard pitch shots, if it's 20 yards, I take my hands back to 8, turn the body through to my hands are 4. If it's 30 yards, I take it back to 8 o'clock with the hands, and turn the body through until my hands are about waist high, like a 3 o'clock position, and the ball will fly a little further. And just keep the same tempo. That's what Ted Shestick has taught me. It's worked really well for me and my students. Brad, I don't know what you do as far as the short, you know, whether it's 20 or 30-yard pitch shots, but that seemed to work fairly well for me.
Brad, hang on just one second before I get you to jump in here. I think Michael raised a very valid point here. Is I think that confidence is certainly a big factor. I think by the sounds of what I'm reading from Roger's email here, is it sounds like this is a shot. You know, obviously he needs to work on his approach shots a little bit more, so he's not leaving himself that. But obviously he's found himself in this a number of times, and I think probably what's happened over time is from not, hitting the shot well, it's left him a little skittish, if you will, for lack of better words. And he's now sort of lost some confidence. And also, as Michael had talked about, you know, if he's hitting it with a wedge, his wedge may have a little bit too much bounce. So let's take away from Michael's answer here, and instead of using, say, a 7-iron, if he does need to use a wedge, maybe there is a small bunker or something in front that he needs to go over, how can he hit those wedge shots a little bit more? And then I'll let you respond in general. I'm sorry, Brad. Yeah, pardon me. I'm sorry, Brad.
Okay. The thing that I do with my students is if they have to hit a pitch shot, you know, I always say, you know, try to putt it first. If you can't putt, you're going to chip. If you can't chip, you're going to pitch. And so if they have a bunker in front of them, you know, I definitely want them to hit more of a high and lofty shot. And the first thing I try to do is help them understand how the sand wedge works in a swing. It has bounce on it, and the bounce is designed to help you hit that shot better. And so I go through the kind of scenario of showing them, you know, how the bounce works in a sand wedge. And then, you know, to me, a pitch shot is simply the beginning of a full swing. And I think a lot of people are trying to do a lot of special stuff. They open the face, open their stance, a lot of things that I think that make it a little more difficult. And I say, look, we're just going to hit, you know, a, a, make a swing here that we normally be working on in our full swing. And, you know, I think that for me, I mean, I think that the clock system is great. For me, I found that pace is a huge issue with a lot of people.
Right.
People that are trying to hit this little short shot, they get very short in their swing. It gets kind of out of sequence a lot because they're trying to make a small swing and try to hit a, you know, kind of rush through the shot on the way down, and it gets very jerky and very hard
yep.
to actually use the club. So with those kind of people, I have them work more on their pace. We talk about, you know, how the pace of a golf swing needs to work to help control the distance, how far it goes. So I kind of go more on pace, and then I tell them, look, we're going to make the same golf swing we've been making, you know, been working on in your full swing. We're just going to work on the beginning of that full swing where they still have some wrist in action. And I definitely want them to understand that on the way back, the face has to open. On the way down, the face has to close. So I work on this wrist action where the face is opening and closing, and all of a sudden the bounce starts hitting the ground. And so they don't dig, they don't scull it, but the bounce kind of helps it not go on the ground too much. So I had them do that a lot. We make a lot of rehearsal swings to get them confident with making a little bigger swing. Not full, but bigger swing. And it becomes more of a pace issue. They get more relaxed and kind of getting into more of a slow pace, and they tend to hit shots that are better because they're not allowing that abrupt action to happen, and they get more of a feeling of using the face and using the club. Some people, I think, kind of work on their body too much in the golf swing, and I want people to understand in this shot, you've got to really work more on how your hands are working, which controls what the face is doing. They get a feel for the weight of the head, and they start swinging more of the club head, and they hit higher, easier shots.
Right. And I think, you know, the hands are, you know, often neglected by a lot of, especially high handicap golfers. I think, especially on a short shot like this where, you know, they don't really need to obviously take a full swing, but they get very stiff and rigid with their wrist. They almost lock their wrist. And a lot of times I think that adds and compounds the problem because what often happens is, you know, in that pace as you're talking about, Brad, as they're going back with a sort of a stiff and rigid hand, often what happens is that club face is not opening as needed and or closing, and more often than not, they end up coming in behind the ball and hitting that turf first, and quite often, as Roger indicates, thinning it out and getting a little bit too much bounce in there. But, again, some great answers, and I think that, you know, there's really no perfect, you know, answer for, you know, for a lot of questions because it really depends. There's so many variables that can happen. But, you know, ideally what we want to do here, guys, is we want to be able to give them some options. And I think you guys have done that great. Michael, you know, you've talked about in a case, you know, maybe using a 7-iron or something that, you know, when the way is clear. And of course, Brad, you know, when we've got some obstacles to go over, we need to get more of a pitching wedge or even a sand wedge and using a slightly different technique. So we want to make sure that we give everybody some options, and you guys certainly have done that. And great job. Thank you.
Sure.
I'm going to move on to our next question here. This is from Riley up in your neck of the woods, or close to your neck of the woods, I believe, Michael, Erie, Pennsylvania. And funny enough, he's talking about a bunker shot, and this is one that a lot of people are faced with, and here's what he had to say, short and sweet. He says, I struggle with bunker shots, especially a buried lie, or often referred to as even a fried egg lie, as it's often called. What is the best way to handle this type of shot? And Brad, I'm going to let you, even though you finished off, I'm going to let you start on this one here. A fried egg and actually buried lie are really not exactly the same because more often not buried can be a little deeper and stuck in the sand. Fried eggs,
right.
You know, even though it's a little deeper in. But let's handle both of them. Let's do with an actual buried lie where it's actually plugged right into the sand. Let's start with that one, and then we'll talk about, because there are techniques are slightly a little bit different. Let's start with the buried lie first, Brad.
Well, you know, in the buried lie, the first thing you got to look is what do you have face in front of you? Do you have a big lip on the bunker? Is it not a big lip? And, you know, because those options are very important, because if there is a huge lip on the bunker, I mean, we got to go sideways. I mean, it just won't come out. As far as technique-wise, what I do is I make sure that we don't do things like really open the face up very much. I've never liked that option of opening the face in a bunker. What I do is I actually add loft to the face, and I kind of lay the hands back behind the ball and address. And for every bunker shot, whether it be red lie, fried egg, or even, you know, just a normal lie, what I want them to do is the club has to work very much outside on the way back. It has to work very much inside on the way through. And with this type of shot, what I want them to do is make this very exaggerated outside move on the way back. And when they come down, I want them to leave the club in the sand. That way it's going to get actually under that ball, below the ball, and then the face can lift the sand can lift the ball out of the bunker. It won't have much spin on it or tend to run very much once it gets out of the bunker, but I kind of like a very exaggerated outside swing. When they come down, you know, by hitting behind the ball and leaving the club in the sand, it's going to get, you know, below the ball, and the sand can actually lift it out. It's a very aggressive, a very powerful shot. I mean, you don't want to go at it very easy. I've had a lot of success with people, you know, getting that ball out of the bunker. And the first thing they want to do is get it out, and that's what that technique does.
And let me just to add on to that, or get you to add on this rather, Brad. You know, traditionally we always hear sort of 1 to 2 inches behind the ball with sort of a standard traditional bunker shot. In this particular case, how far behind the ball should Riley be hitting behind the sand? Should he hit directly behind the ball, or should he allow maybe an inch or so?
By moving the ball forward in your stance, I like to play the ball off my left foot if I'm a right-handed golfer. They're going to tend to hit behind the golf ball, and I kind of give them a set, say, look, just somewhere behind the golf ball within reason. It might be an inch, might be 2 inches, might be 3 inches, just as long as it's behind the ball. I really don't go into, you know, real detail about, okay, how far behind it, because no one can hit it the exact same spot every time. But by having the ball forward in your stance, being very much of an outside backswing and then coming to the inside, they're going to find behind the golf ball. It's a very steep action. I just tell them somewhere behind the golf ball within reason.
Great answer. Michael, I'm going to let you tackle on the other end of the spectrum a little bit more of the fried egg lie. So obviously a little bit different than the buried lie. I mean, certainly the ball sitting down a little further in the sand than traditional, but a fried egg lie, of course, a little bit different. How would you recommend that Riley handles this one?
Yeah, I mean, I approach them both very similarly. I think, the you know, like Brad said, you got to be a little more aggressive when the ball is completely buried, just because there's a lot more sand immediately around the golf ball. In the fried egg lie, I mean, the bottom line, when you're in the bunker, you have to get the club underneath the ball. You can't, even if you hit 2 inches behind the ball, if the club's exiting out and not getting underneath the ball, you could still scull the ball. It's still possible.
Right.
Obviously, if you still want to hit behind the ball, 2 inches is great, 1 inch is great. But as long as you're getting the club underneath the golf ball and throwing the sand out onto the green, that's good. You still have to understand that, you know, a fried egg, the ball's probably not going to spin very much. So, you know, even if you're at a tight pin, you're just going to have to accept the fact that you're going to need some room to let the ball run out. I like leaving the face pretty square with fried eggs.
Mm-hmm.
I look at it as, you know, I try and get the club to enter the sand, you know, just behind where the circle of the fried egg is, you know, not inside. Mm-hmm. You don't want inside of the egg because you tend to hit the ball a little thin that way because the sand goes down, so you're probably going to catch the ball. But if you can get right at the edge of that, right at the edge or just behind the edge of the fried egg, you can get and continue the downward angle of attack to get the club underneath the golf ball and throw the sand and the ball out of the bunker, and just know that the ball is going to release a little bit. Just like Brad said, you still want to have a pretty steep angle of attack. So you want to swing that club a little bit steeper, a little bit more outside, and then down through the golf ball. I think, really the only difference is with a fried egg, you may be able to follow through a little bit more just because there's not as much sand that you have to displace that's immediately around the ball.
Right.
But still, I mean, especially for a beginner that's trying, or someone who's having trouble with that shot, just hit down on it, leave the club in the sand. Just get the ball in the sand out. That's the ultimate goal.
Yep.
Get it out of the bunker, and get it on the green or somewhere around the green where at least you can try and salvage a par or a bogey, and you know, get, you know, don't try and hit the miraculous shot when you don't have to.
Right, and those are some excellent points, guys. Let me just add to it as well. I think one of the things that I've seen more often not in you know, playing with amateurs particularly, is and especially bunkers. I think most amateurs are terrified of bunker shots, and really it's probably one of the easiest shots to handle. In most cases, now obviously buried lie is a little bit unpredictable, but your sort of run-of-the-mill traditional bunker shot is actually a little easier shot to, at times to hit, but it's still very intimidating for most amateur golfers. But I think sometimes one of the biggest mistakes that I see, and Brad, you kind of alluded to this in your early response, is that sometimes, you know, don't need to go for the flag, you know, you may have to go sideways if the shot requires it. Don't always be too aggressive. And I think sometimes the amateurs feel that, you know, they need to be shooting for the pin all the time. And if you, especially if you've got a tight pin, sometimes you might want to hit it off, you know, to a fatter part of the green and still allow yourself, you know, obviously an opportunity to putt. But if you're shooting to, you know, an area of the green that's a little bit narrower and just because the pin's there, then you're creating a bigger margin of error, because if the ball, if you don't hit it just, you know, hit the shot just right, especially with the buried lie where you're not going to get a lot of control, then you're going to end up running off that part of the green. So sometimes it's better to aim a little bit away from what your intended target is just to play a safer shot. And I think that's something that I think a lot of amateurs need to do, and just, you know, as you said, Michael, you know, maybe get away with a par or even a bogey as opposed to maybe turning into a double or even a triple bogey by taking a too aggressive shot. But great answers, guys, and appreciate that. Any other comments either one of you want to make on Riley's question?
No, I think we covered it all there. Yeah.
Yeah, I think we're right on.
Okay, sounds good. Well, I want to thank you guys for that. With some great answers there. And the next question here is from Casey up in Manhattan, New York, right in the Big Apple. And it's a short game question. He's not really, but he says, thanks for taking the question. He says, I've played for a few years but still struggle with my especially short pits and chipping. Short pitch shots and chipping. Do you have some drills that I can do to become a better short game player? I'm glad that really this question's come in. I know we've talked about this in past shows and that, but I'm glad that more golfers are starting to recognize the importance of working on a short game. You know, for a long, long time, everybody was, well, how can I hit my driver further? And there's still lots of guys out there that want to do that, but I think that more and more people are starting to recognize that you know, those 100 yards and in shots are more important, and especially your short pitch and your chip shot. So, Brad, I'm going to start back with you. Let's start with the pitch shots first. What are some good drills that we can set Casey up with here to help him be a better short game player?
Well, I really like to use alignment rods. I use a lot in my teaching, and what I'll do is I build them a little station. Number one, with a pitch shot, and again, you know, 30, 40 yards, I don't want them to do a whole lot. You know, people try to get their face open, get their body open. What I'll do is lay an alignment rod down the ground, and I'll say, look, this is parallel to your target, and I want to keep your feet parallel to the target. And then when they sit up to it, I'll have them take another alignment rod and kind of put it behind that one, that's in line with kind of the angle of the club shaft at address, and that way they know where the club should go relative to that rod, because, you know, I'm really big on the club traveling on the right angle. I don't want it to go too far inside, too far outside for the shot. And then at address, you know, I tell them, I say, look, what I want you to do is lay the hands back a little bit behind the golf ball. That kind of exposes more of the bounce to the ground. And I want you to make basically your golf swing. We're going to take some pace off, make it a little shorter. But I really want you to use, I want you to use the club face a lot. And I think, again, like you alluded to earlier, that is that people tend to get very stiff, try to hit this little punch shot, which is a shot in golf. There's no question about it. Mm-hmm. That is a shot in golf. You have a little punch shot where you kind of run up on the green. But for a pitch shot, I want to get the golf ball in the air, so I'm going to have them, you know, use the bounce of the golf club and use the golf club itself. So dilemma rod makes them sure that they're not getting too open or too close. Their body is pretty parallel to the target. The rod in the back that's in the ground, sticking in the ground on the same angle as their club shaft address, helps them understand I want that club to go back more along that rod. I don't want to go inside of it or way outside of it. I want to kind of go back along it, which would be just slightly above it, but it would be more along it. And they kind of get the wrist to cock and get
right.
that club on that angle halfway back. And so by having that angle there, whenever they use their wrists and their hands to hit this shot where they can get, let the bounce of the club hit the ground, golf ball gets in the air very nicely.
Yeah, and great way to put that. What's one of the more Michael? Before I go on to you, Brad, what's one of the more common errors that you see with a lot of, especially high handicap golfers in the pitch shots? What are some? I know you talked about it a little bit, but what's some of the more common errors that you see them doing out there that they need to correct?
They get their feet really open, aim way left if they're a right-handed golfer, aim their feet way left. They take the face and turn it to the right. And they think by having their feet left and the face right, they're swinging that the golf ball should go in the middle. Well, yeah, that's a way to do it, but it's an awful difficult way to do it. I see that the people get way too open, the face gets way too open, their body gets way too open, and it's very hard to swing from there. I mean, it's a golf swing, it's a golf club. It's, you know, it's got the same angle, you know, it's got an angle like all other clubs do. It needs to swing on that angle. Now, obviously, wedge shots. The sandwich is a more upright line angle, and the driver is a flat line angle.
Mm-hmm.
But both have an angle, and so it's a golf swing. I mean, it's not something so special that you have to do 90 different things to make it go in the air. I mean, my 6-iron goes in the air, my 7-iron goes in the air. So why am I trying to make all these special adjustments at address? And that's what a lot of people do.
Yeah.
They make it way too complicated. And for me, it's just a smaller version of my full swing. It's a little softer, a little you know, slower swing, but it's still a golf swing.
Right, and that's a valid point. And I think what a lot of people get confused with, and because they'll, you know, when they're watching golf on television, they'll see how the pros line up, and certainly some of the pros, depending on the shots, you'll see them. We're primarily talking about right-handed golfers, flip it around the other way if you're a left-handed golfer. But you know, sometimes you'll see them sneak that left foot, pull it back just a little bit, just to allow them to clear their hips a little bit. But I think people misunderstand that the pro is not actually, you know, turning his entire body to the left. He's just moving that left foot just a little bit, just to open up his hips a little bit. And that's okay to do, I think, but you still need to keep your shoulder square to your target line. And a lot of times what happens, you know, the amateur golfers end up opening up, and then they've got a compensate club, and it's not that you can't do this. It's very difficult in your backswing you get very rigid. And, you know, some of the pros might be able to get away with it, but a lot of the amateurs get, you know, it's almost like a contortionist trying to twist and turn and get things lined. So I think what you said is spot on, and that's a for see if you're live here tonight. Don't twist your body and get into, you know, two or three different positions to hit this shot. You're going to get the balls up in the air. Michael, let's tackle on the chipping end of it, if you don't mind. BC up in New York here. What are some great drills or some things you'd like to get your students to do to help them with their chipping?
Yeah, I think chipping, the, you know, really the most important part of chipping is really just getting set up properly to the golf ball. You know, I think what I do with a lot of my students, especially beginners, higher handicappers, I think they tend to, you know, try and lift the ball up in the air, just like what Brad was trying to say. You don't have to worry about getting the ball up in the air. The ball will go up in the air. So one of the things I do, the chipping stroke is a little different than a putting stroke, but to keep it simple, I try and just, especially with beginners, let's try and get it to feel almost like a putting stroke. I get them to set up to the ball. You know, we'll start off with like a 7, 8, 9 iron, something like that, depending on how far away the hole is that we're chipping to. Have them set up to the ball like we're going to hit a putt. And then it's just a couple-step process where we have I just have them grip down and move that ball to their right foot, assuming they're a right-handed golfer. Just basically just move the ball back in their stance a little bit. Put a little more weight on their left leg, so that way they don't have to feel like they're helping the ball up in the air at all. And then from there, just move maybe just a little closer to the ball and just make what feels like a putting stroke, and the ball will naturally bottom out in front of the ball. Now, if they start to hit a little bit behind the golf ball, I'll just take an alignment rod, lay it down just behind the ball, about, you know, two, three inches behind the ball, and have them swing above the alignment rod, and that will prevent them from hitting behind the ball. Basically, if the ball is off the right foot, we'll take the alignment rod, and be perpendicular to the target line, so it'll be kind of along, facing the direction the golfer's facing, and just to the right of the right foot, and then have them, put the weight forward, ball back in your stance, and then feel like you're making a putting stroke where they're lifting the club up above the alignment rod and swinging through.
Right. Excellent.
Sorry, go ahead.
Excellent point. Let me just add to this as well, if I can, just guys here for a second. One of the things that I think that most of the amateur golfers have a problem with is not utilizing their practice sessions, and we've talked about this in past shows. Practicing with a purpose, and I think that the short game is probably an area that a lot of people really miss the boat on. And we've all seen it, I'm sure. You'll be up on the practice range and everybody's pulling out their driver and they're hitting, a dozen or two there, worried about where it's going. And, they'll go over maybe on the putting green and make a few putts. They might do a chip or so, but there's really no purpose behind it. And, I think that what we need to do is sort of retrain the golfer's mind, if you will, by getting them to focus more in breaking up their practice time in whatever it may be, if it's 30 minutes, if it's an hour, what have you. And I'm not talking about before they're going out to play, because that's a little bit different. But, if you're going to go up to the range and work on some of the things that your instructors taught you, you need to be able to practice with purpose. And I think that's something that, Casey should be doing here with a short game. And I suspect that, if that's an area that he's most golfers struggle with, and that's why we see so many people having a difficult time, breaking 100 even. And I think that, the more that we can instill that practice with a sense of purpose into the average golfer out there, I think you're going to start seeing some of these scores improve. But some great answers, guys. And any other further comments on either some short pitch shots or chipping from either one?
No, the point you made about purpose, Ted, is a good one, because with my students, I try to tell them, I said, look, we need to practice with a purpose. We got to practice the right things, practice the right way, the right amount with them. I want them to have some feedback with that, and then practice only when they're motivated to practice. So, those things I think are huge when it comes to practicing, is you got to follow kind of that general rule there of practice with a purpose and practice the right way, the right things, the right amount, and only practice when you're actually motivated to practice.
Yeah, and you have to make it fun. And I think, there's a lot of great drills that are out there that you can, go with a buddy, let's say, and make it a little bit more interesting in that. But I think, as I was alluding to, I think one of the biggest, things I always get, and I'm sure that both of you have probably heard some of the same stories, but, everybody talks about they want to improve and they can't understand why they can't, break 100 or what have you. And, when I ask them, what they do when they go up to the driving range, or I'll see them if I'm out at a club and I'm watching, if I go up and I'm hitting some balls myself, I'll kind of just observe how people put together sort of a practice session. And it's just very, nonchalant. There's really no organization to it. And yet people don't seem to understand why their games aren't improving. Well, part of the reason is they're not doing it with a purpose. Now, again, practicing in a full-blown sort of practice session is entirely different than a warm-up before you're playing, in a tournament, or you're playing you know, with your buddies on the weekend, you're obviously not going to, you know, sort of reinvent the wheel at that time. But I think if you've got, you know, 30 minutes to an hour to go up and really utilize that time and you want to improve your game, then you have to practice with a sense of purpose. And I think that, you know, Casey here in New York poses a question I think a lot of golfers have out there is the short game it can be really very simple, but it takes some practice and some thought and some effort. And I think that when people start to realize that and start to put some of these tips and drills that we're giving them here tonight to practice, I think that they're going to start to see some significant improvements in their game.
True.
Guys, just before we move on to the next question here, I just want to quickly remind everybody, of course, that we're live on Golf Talk Live here at blogtalkradio.com. And you can certainly call in if you want during the broadcast, and you can do so at area code 646-716-4667. Or you can email questions if you want to ted.golftalklive@gmail.com. Certainly more than happy to take any questions from you during the broadcast. And you can also check us out on Facebook at facebook.com/golftalklive blog. Make sure you have blog on the end of that. And also follow me on Twitter at tedandbuckceo. And don't forget to check out the website at golftalkliveblog.com. You're here tonight, of course, on the panel with Michael Wheeler, PGA Director of Instruction at the Bellwood Golf and Country Club up in Pennsylvania, and, of course, Brad Redding, PGA Master Teaching Professional and the Director of Instruction at the Members Club at Grand Dunes in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. And, of course, he is the owner-operator of Brad Redding Golf. Guys, let's take another question here. This is from Martin up in Athens, Georgia, and he also has an interesting question, which we haven't had on the panel here yet. And like most golfers, he says, I find myself hitting from the rough several times in a round, of course, with various results. I'm not sure what the best way to play from thick rough, so I thought I would pose this to the panel. What is the best or proper way to hit this shot? So, you know, let's there's obviously, again, a multitude of scenarios here, but let's say you know, Martin here is his tee shot, and he's maybe gone into some, not the first cut, but maybe into the second cut of rough. It's a little bit thicker than that, and now he's got it faced with a dilemma. And we'll use a par four as an example where he does have an opportunity. If he wanted to go to the green, he could. What are some ways that he should handle this from hitting from the thick rough? And Michael, we're going to go with you first, if that's okay.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, you know, it depends on a couple of different things. One, what's in front of you. Obviously, you know, bunkers, you have to carry additional rough, you have to carry water, things like that. But as far as the shot is concerned, we'll just say a 7-iron, for instance, say he has a 7-iron out of the rough. You know, what happened when the club head enters the rough tends to grab the hosel of the golf club and starts to close the face a little bit. So the tendency is to miss a little bit left, and it will also obviously slow the club down a little bit. So what I usually teach my students is, you want to change your angle of attack a little bit, maybe swing downward a little bit more, try and get as much, you know, when you're in the rough, especially heavy rough, you want to try and get as much contact with the ball as possible, because the rough, the grass will get in the way between the club and the ball. The way I teach is, say, you know, for instance, say we're using a 7-iron, you know, if their normal setup is, for instance, say 3 inches inside the left heel, just move it back a little bit more. Maybe just 1 inch a little bit further back in your stance. Maybe put a little bit more weight onto their lead leg, their left side if they're right-handed. And just try and make a good soft swing, maybe swing just a little bit harder to try and get through the rough, especially if it's thick rough. And just, you know, kind of swing more downward, trying to just get as much ball contact as possible. And, you know, we're just trying to get the ball out and not near the green. I mean, that's more of a recovery shot than it is a
a
shot that we're trying to get close. But yeah, I mean, those are the things I would do. Just maybe move it back in your stance a little bit. You know, one thing that I've heard a couple of other teachers say is that some of them teach them to grip a little bit harder on the club. Maybe strengthen the pressure of their hands a little bit, just to resist the club from turning. That can help sometimes. Just be wary of the fact that it could potentially turn the club over. So if there's trouble left of the green, you might want to think about aiming a little bit right to just in case it does miss left. Just speed it up a little bit, back in the stance maybe a little bit more and try and hit down on it just slightly more to get a little bit more of the ball contact as opposed to getting all that rough stuff between the face and the ball.
Right, and that's a great answer, Michael, and that's really you know how most people should be handling that type of shot. But every once in a while we get faced, and of course we're going to get Brad to jump in here now. We're going to change the scenario just a little bit, Brad. We're going to take this up a notch, and it's going to be a par five now, where we've got a little bit further distance, and maybe a little more course management is going to come in here. Martin's found himself again from his tee shot in the rough. He's got a pretty long carry before he's going to get the green. He's got a good opportunity maybe for a layup shot, and maybe hit a third shot from the fairway. Is the smart play for somebody that's maybe not as good hitting out of the rough to try and go for a par five in two, or should he maybe laying up, or what are some options? What should be going through Martin's mind at this point?
There's three scenarios here as far as how I get people to handle this. If you're a higher handicapper, all you want to do, get the ball back in the fairway. And I don't care if you have to hit a sand wedge or a 9-iron or whatever, just get it back in the fairway, which means they're probably going to have to make more of a fuller swing and just get it back in the fairway. We've taken par out of the equation. They're going to probably have a bogey on the hole, but at least they won't have a 10. The mid-handicapper, what I'd have them do is similar to what Michael said. I mean, ball's going to go back in my stance a little bit. I'm going to make a very full golf swing. I see a lot of players that hit this shot that kind of stop at impact. They hit down so much that it just stops at impact. And what you want to do is make a complete full follow-through. I mean, they're going to hit down on it anyway because the ball's back in the stance. A little steeper attack on the way down. Like Michael said, catch a lot of golf ball. But, man, keep going. I want that follow-through to be all the way through to the finish. That'd be more the mid-handicapper. And they're probably going to definitely lay up. I mean, you know, if they have to, if it's, let's say, 200 yards to the green, you know, pull out a 7-iron, a 6-iron, and get it down the fairway. You know, obviously you got to understand what's in front of them as far as bunkers and water, if there's anything like that. But get it down there where they at least have something more like maybe a 9-iron into the green, and they still make, you know, birdie or par. The really good player,
right.
I mean, the guy who I consider, you know, a low handicapper, tour pro, you know, they can still make that motion and get it to the green. They've got great hand and eye coordination. They make full big swings, and they get it back, you know, can get it very close to the green, obviously. But the way I look at it is that, you know, there's sometimes you just can't hit the shot you want to hit. I mean, I remember
right.
one time that Tom Kite was playing the U.S. Open, and, you know, he needed to hit a four-wood to get the ball to the green, but he's in rough. He tried to hit the four-wood and moved it about 8 feet in front of him and you know, ended up making bogey, or actually double bogey, and lost the tournament by two shots. So there's sometimes
yep.
you just can't hit the shot you want to hit. But, again, if I'm a mid-handicapper, which sounds like Mark is, what I want them to do is you know, make a move the ball back in the stance a little bit, steeper angle approach like Michael said, but make sure you keep going. I mean, don't stop at impact. Keep that club moving through it so you can kind of get through some of that rough and get the golf ball down the fairway.
Right, and let me just throw this in here. I remember, and gosh, if memory serves me correct, one of you two might recollect us better, but back, I believe it was in the early 2000s, and I believe it was at the Buick Open, and Tiger Woods was in some pretty nasty rough, and I remember he hit, if I'm not mistaken, it was a 6-iron out of the rough and put it quite close on the green to the pin, and a lot of people were baffled like that. But, you know, he did really what you're talking about here, Brad, is you know, he didn't stop, you know, at impact. He really powered through. Now, obviously, Tiger, you know, is a very strong guy and is able to do that. And but that is important. You know, you have to really power through that rough sometimes, especially
right.
if you got into thick rough. But not everybody's obviously able to do that. And I think for some of the higher handicappers, you raised really an excellent point. You know, if you're a high handicapper, even if you're within, as Michael talked about earlier, in range of, say, a 7-iron, if you're not a great player and really have good control on your ball striking, you don't need to be hitting, going for that green. Take a sand wedge or pitching wedge or something, as Brad had alluded to, and just get it back in play. Get it back in the fairway and set up for a third shot. And you might end up making bogey, and you might end up even making double bogey, but it's a lot better than turning it into an 8, 9, or a 10. And I think sometimes it really, as I mentioned, it boils down to course management. I think that's probably the number one killer of most people, especially the high handicappers. The pros and low handicappers obviously have worked through a lot of that, but even they sometimes can make mistakes, Brad, as you indicated, with Tom Kite. But I think a lot of the players, high handicappers especially out there, need to really stop and think. And this is where, I want to get into something here very quickly, and then we're going to wrap up for tonight. I launched another program a few weeks ago, or a little over a month ago, called Women of Golf, and co-hosted with LPGA professional Cindy Miller. And she's just started a new series last week called Owning Your Game. And it's going to be a great series, but it talks about really people, having to decide why they're there playing. What are they're trying to accomplish? Are they just out, having a good time? Are they, a serious golfer? And really understanding. And I think that when people sort of own their game and understand where they're coming from and what it is that they're trying to accomplish, that will sort of dictate their style of play. For somebody that's just out there having a good time and wants to, maybe moderately improve, you don't need to be going for the green. You need to be smart about it and have fun. For those that are a little bit more accomplished, you can sort of step it up a little bit and be a little bit more aggressive in your play, especially on a shot like this where you're hitting a thick and heavy rough. And I think that people need to understand what level of game that they want to play at. Obviously, if they're wanting to be out on the tour someday, that's a whole different kettle of fish. But for the average golfer out there, they need to be realistic in their play, and they need to really use some course management and really think about the shots. Just because your friend over there hit it out in the rough and got it on the green doesn't mean that you're going to. So you need to play to your own ability. And if you're having a tough time hitting it out of the rough, as Martin indicates here, then maybe sometimes the smarter play is to do as Brad suggested and just take that higher lofted club and just get it back in play, hit it out to the fairway. Guys, what do you think about that? Is that something that you're seeing a lot of too with people out there that you're working with, that they're maybe just not realistic in their approach on the game?
Yeah.
Sorry, Brad.
Sorry, Michael, go ahead.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
Yeah, sure.
Go
ahead. Yeah, I mean, I see that a lot where, they overestimate what they can accomplish. I mean, I always love the analogy. I mean, this year the U.S. Open's going back to Pinehurst, and look what happened in 1999, a year after Payne Stewart, lost by, one or two shots, something like that. He knocks it in the rough, right side of the green. He's got a cross bunker that he's got to carry, and we're talking about a tour player. He put his ego aside and said to himself, look, what is my best opportunity to make a par? And if you watch the Golf's Greatest Round the other night, you heard him in the interview afterwards say, he trusts his wedge game. That's what he said. I trust my wedge game, so let's get it down there to a spot where I can hit a wedge on the green and give myself the best chance for par and win this thing outright. So that's what, if Payne Stewart, arguably one of the greatest players at that time and that week, he was the greatest player of the week, can put his ego aside and say, look, my best opportunity right now is to make par with a wedge, not put it in the cross bunker, not put it in more deep rough. Let's get it back in the fairway. Let's get it, I think it was like 85 yards away with his last shot, put it to 15 feet, and made the putt that we all remember. But, bottom line is, if you watch his golf swing, just like Brad said, he didn't stop at impact. He didn't decelerate. He accelerated through. He just picked the club that would get him to his number, whether that's a wedge, whether that's a 7-iron, whether that's, an 8-iron, it doesn't matter. He picked the appropriate club, made the appropriate swing, and followed through, good acceleration, and just used his course management to make par and win the U.S. Open. And take that to your normal player. I mean, a lot of people overestimate, I want to hit that great, miraculous shot. Well, fortunately, you're probably not going to pull it off 9 times out of 10. One out of 100
right.
will be awesome, especially if you're talking fescue, like we have a lot of fescue at Bellwood, or thick rough. Just just hit the shot. Give yourself the best chance for par. Worst case scenario, you're making a bogey. Get out of there. Get rid of the eights and sevens and nines. You know, just, you know, follow Payne Stewart's lead. He kind of knew what he was doing.
Yeah, he certainly did, and I certainly miss seeing Payne out on tour. It was a certainly big loss for the game when he left us. But a great point, Michael. And Brad, you wanted to add some thoughts into this as well?
Well, you know, people watch, obviously, golf on TV, and they watch these pros hitting these incredible shots, and, you know, someone will say, well, I saw, you know, Tom Watson do this, and I said, well, with all due respect, you're not Tom Watson, you know. I mean, you know, the shot you need to hit is a shot where you're going to make, you know, no worse, like Michael said, no worse than bogey. And, you know, a great point is, you know, a 7's better than an 8, 8's better than a 9, a 9's better than a 10, and an 11's no good, but it's a whole lot better than a 12. So I tell people, I say, look, you know, at your level, all I want you to do is get the golf ball down the fairway, back into the fairway. If you have to hit a 7-iron, an 8-iron, a 9-iron, whatever you have to do to get it back in the fairway and then proceed from there and play for, like, you know, we've changed the hole from a par 4 to a par 5 now, and your goal is to make a 5.
Yeah. Well, and it brings up really you know, a thought here. I think what happens with a lot of players, and obviously, you know, we have to factor in, you know, slow play and things like that. People can't be out there for an hour trying to assess a situation. But, you know, when you are faced with a scenario, you need to really think about it. And you need to, you know, some things have to go through your head. It's not just a matter of, well, how do I play this shot? It's about what are the intended consequences of that shot. If it's a difficult shot and I run the risk of turning maybe a par into a double or triple bogey as opposed to playing a safer shot and maybe just coming up with just a bogey or maybe making that par, then I have to sort of play that percentage shot. And if you look at a lot of the pros, especially some of the older pros that have, you know, talked about it, Nicholas and some of the other ones that were sort of a thinker of the game more so than just a player, you know, that's what they did. They thought their way around the golf course. They looked at the scenario, they assessed the situation, and they played what they felt was their highest percentage shot. Now, obviously, they had certain abilities that some of the higher handicappers didn't have, so they were able to pull off some of those shots. But there were a lot of times, too, as Michael, as you indicated, with Payne Stewart, you know, he knew what his limitations were, and he knew that it was an important tournament that it was in, and the smart play was not to go for it at one point, but then to go for it at a different point. And he knew how to play that percentage shot when it was the right time to play it. And the high handicap golfers, Brad, as you indicated, and I'm hoping that guy's still your friend now that you said he wasn't Tom Watson, but you know, but that's true. You know, these guys see the pros on TV, whether it's the men's or even the ladies. I think the ladies are a little bit, I'll be honest, a little smarter about it when they see some of the female pros out there. I think they know better. But some of the guys out there that, you know, the testosterone gets going and they think that they can do it. And, they, you know, these are shots, you know, I don't know of too many people that go up to a driving range and hit balls out of the rough. You know, they're hitting it on a nicely mowed and manicured teeing area, and a lot of times they're hitting it off the tees. So they've got a perfect condition. Now, I'll see occasionally some people will go down to the end of the range and they'll, you know, throw a few balls into a rough situation and practice, and that's great. But most people don't do that. So, you know, if you're not somebody that's practicing that shot a lot, then you really have no need, unless you're a good player to begin with, trying to go for it, because you're just going to compound, you know, the error even more. And as you both have had indicated, you know, you're turning a 7 into an 8 or 8 into a 9 and so on and so forth. So if I'm going to ask each of you here before we wrap up, if you could sort of instill one thought or maybe two thoughts to all of the caller or the participants tonight in Coach's Corner, what would you suggest to them about working on their game? What direction would you send them in? Brad, let's start with you.
Well, I mean, you know, first I want to get the skill level down. I have two types of practice. I want them into practice to get the skill down. They're going to hit, you know, three or four clubs to a specific target, and they're working, no competition. It's just mainly working on skill, developing their skill level. And then I want to have another one called, what I call transfer. and they practice more like they play on the golf course. They actually do a scenario where they actually hit a, they build themselves a fairway out there on the range, hit the driver. If the golf ball does not go in that area, they have to go off to the side, hit a shot, and maybe a 7 or 8 iron to a green out of rough. And they say, well, I can't hit the shot, you know, so I'm going to hit more of a shot where I kind of lay it up short of the green. And then they hit a pitch shot onto the green. You know, I have them actually practice scenario where they're actually practicing more like they play. But the first thing they got to do is develop a skill. I mean, they have to have the skill to be able to hit those shots. And then once they get that skill down, definitely build it up more where they actually hit, they practice more like they play.
Right. Michael, what about you when you're working with students, Matt? What is something that you want to make sure that they understand when they take away from a lesson?
You know, I want, just like with Brett, I want them to understand that learning to play golf and improving your game, whether you're a tour player or whether you're a 35 handicap, it's a process. You know, you have to change motion, but you know, at the same time, when you're playing golf, you don't want to think about the motion. You want to just pick your target and trust that your golf swing is going to send the ball to the target. One thing that I try to go over with all my students in the first few lessons is, you know, cause and effect of why the ball does what it does. You know, as far as if you hit a slice, which probably 90% of golfers do, why does the ball slice? Well, face was open to your path. Why, you know, give them some examples and show them, actually demonstrate it on the range and say, look, if your path is left, your face is open, the ball will cut. But having them understand that, so that way as they improve, they can say, you know, all right, well, that, you know, I tried to play a draw, I kind of double-crossed it and hit a little bit of a fade. Why did that happen? They can now understand why that happened. But understanding that the golf swing, changing your golf swing and improving your game is a process, that it's not going to happen overnight. I mean, you're never going to go to a music teacher and say, hey, I want to learn to play the saxophone, and I need to learn how to play it proficiently and professionally by next Friday. It's just not going to happen. Yeah. You have to practice, and each lesson is, you know, builds upon the next. It's all about just making sure that the repetitions you're doing, and what we talked about earlier with focused practice, and like what Brad said, taking practice and changing motion to transfer practice and taking it to the golf course, is extremely important. So, you know, just the cause and effect, and then understanding that, you know, it is a process. Be patient. You know, it's not going to happen overnight, but you will get better as the process goes on, and just have fun with it. We play golf because it's fun. We don't play golf because, you know, we have to shoot a 63. That's the pros do that, but even they look at it. It's just a game. You know, it's just a game that we enjoy, and just have a ball with it. You know, the learning process is the best part.
Yeah, and that's a great way to sort of wrap up tonight's Coach's Corner. Guys, thank you for participating tonight. And as we discussed, I'm going to give you both an opportunity. And Michael, since you're in the thought mode here, why don't you start off and just take a moment or two if you want, and just let the listeners know if they want to get in touch with you, where they can get a hold of you, and if you've got anything special, events or things coming up that you want to make aware of.
Yeah, I mean, if anybody needs anything, my website is michaelwheelergolf.com. It's got a lot of my contact information on there. Feel free to send me an email if you have any questions at all or need any help with anything. My email is mwheeler63@pga.com. But you feel free to email me at any point. But, you know, we have a few events come up this year. We're trying to push our junior programs a lot. You know, juniors are a great way to get kids started and involved in the game of golf, getting the kids involved with clinics and learning with other kids. You know, those are probably the bigger programs that we're trying to push this year and get golf ready. We have our first get golf ready for the year, I think the first week of June, if I remember correctly. So, or the second week of June, I'm sorry, the 9th through the 13th. So get golf ready is great for any beginners that want to learn the game. It's really cost effective, $99 for 5 90-minute sessions, and come out, learn the game and learn how to book a tee time, and from how to book a tee time to how to hit a driver all the way down to how to hit a 3-foot putt. So you can pretty much learn anything you need to learn. And, you know, like we said, it's just a process. Go from there. But if you need anything, they can contact me by the website or the email.
Perfect. And Brad, I'll let you finish off.
Well, Ted, really enjoyed this. Thanks for having us on the show. My email address is brad@bradreddinggolf.com. That's my website, which is bradreddinggolf.com. You also can follow me on Twitter, which is Brad Redding Golf, and also follow me on Facebook, which is Brad Redding Golf as well. The big events we have going on this year is we actually have the National Club Pro Championship here in Myrtle Beach this year, and so if you get a chance to come down to watch some very talented PGA golf professionals, it's a great place to come to visit and to watch some great golf. My programs range all the way from half-day schools to three-day golf schools, and a great time to come down to Myrtle Beach and enjoy those. And then also I do private lessons. All my private lessons are 50 minutes. They include computer video analysis, and I would love to help some people down to take advantage of the great weather, the beach, and Brad Redding Golf.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. It's always a pleasure and honor to have some fellow teacher professionals on the show and participating in Coach's Corner. And, Brad, I was glad to have you back as well. Always enjoy your thoughts and input. And, Michael, I was glad that you were able to join in tonight as well. And as I always say to all of my my fellow pros, you're welcome to come back anytime. And Brad, I want to get you on here. I know we've mentioned this before, but we've got to really nail this down. I want to get you back on just for a private interview, just to give you an opportunity to talk a little bit more about Brad Redding Golf. So we're going to set that up in the next few weeks and get you on here. But
that'd be great.
But guys, I want to thank you very much for helping out some of the weekend warriors out there with their golf game, and I know that they'll be tuning in and getting some great tidbits for you guys. So thank you very much for participating, and you guys have a great weekend, and keep doing the great work that you're doing.
Thanks
Michael.
Thanks, Brad.
All right, thanks, guys.
That was great, Ted. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Not a problem. Okay, and just to remind everybody here that we're live on blogtalkradio.com, and all you need to do is just simply type in Golf Talk Live up in the search key at blogtalkradio.com, and you can get us here live every Thursday night starting at 6 p.m. Central Time, running right through till 8 p.m. And if by chance you're not able to join us live, that's not a problem. You can tune in. Just visit the link at www.blogtalkradio.com/Golf Talk Live, and you can check out, scroll down into the on-demand section, and you can check out some of the previously recorded programs. All of the programs, of course, are auto-recorded, even though they are live from 6 to 8. We certainly want you to tune in live, but if you can't make it for scheduling conflicts, that's not a problem. But thanks for tuning in, guys. And my guest this evening is a gentleman that actually reached out to me through social media, as many of them do. And he's got a great product that he's going to talk about here. His name is Greg Jones, and I'm going to bring him out here and let him talk a little bit about a great product called the Nitro Swing Trainer. Greg, welcome to Golf Talk Live.
Well, hello there. Can you hear me okay?
How are you doing? Yeah, I can hear you great. Welcome to Golf Talk Live, and Greg, we're glad that you're able to make it on the program tonight. And I know I was going to have you on here last week, and because of some things that come up, we had to cancel, unfortunately. But I'm glad you were able to come back on this week. I've been looking forward to having you on here. So thanks for joining us on Golf Talk Live, and we'll have a great show together.
Well, I sure appreciate you guys taking the time to listen to something maybe new in the golf market and the golf industry that never really been there before.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. Greg, let me just very quickly before we start, I just want to remind the listeners here, if you want to call in during the next hour on the program, you can certainly do so. You can call in at area code 646-716-4667, and you can speak to either myself or my guest here in the next little bit. But or if you want to just listen in, you can go to blogtalkradio.com and type in Golf Talk Live, and you'll get to the program as well. And don't forget, you can email me anytime at ted.golftalklive@gmail.com if you have any questions or comments that you want me to read out during the program. Greg, before we get started talking about the product, just let everybody know just a little bit about how you got involved in golf and how you got started in golf.
Okay, sure. I actually started golf when I was about age 7, and years ago, my father was always in the skill business. He started into golf when he was 14 and began his career at Clarksburg Country Club in West Virginia as an assistant pro and then as a head pro, and started my brother and I at a young age as golfers, and always became part of the family get-togethers, family everything that we did was all based around golf. As we began to get a little bit older, Dad was in the still business as he got older and had family and children and got kind of out of the golf business, but started back into the golf business in the early 80s, which he received a pretty terrific award, was Custom Club Maker of the Year for Golf Digest in 1985. And at that point, he opened up his first pro shop. And at that point, I opened up my first driving range. So at age 21, I opened up my first driving range, and my father opened up his first pro shop. He opened up a pro shop in the mall, and I opened up a driving range on a small plot of about 17 acres. It used to be a former BMX bike track, and we opened up the driving range. And at first, it wasn't a success, of course. I mean, we would have one or two people a day, and my father likes to tell the story that we picked up golf balls by hand. And it was really quite easy to get golf balls by hand because you only sold 1 to 2 buckets a day.
Right.
So I graduated college, and after I did that, the first year that I graduated college, I got a job at a company as an engineer and opened up the driving range. And that driving range soon became really part of my life in a very short period of time. Like I said, I played golf since the age of 7. Golf was really easy for me. Because I started so young, and I got very good and wanted to play professional golf. And my brother actually took two years after college to try to play on the PGA Tour, and was unsuccessful with that venture, but did play golf and did make a little money at it here and there. And opening up the driving range, like I say, it became a complete passion of mine, and I began to teach, jumped into the PGA in 1995. 1992 actually to 95, and then we expanded our driving range from where we were, actually expanded into a miniature golf course, a race car track, and then sand volleyball. And
wow.
And it went quite well. My girlfriend at the time helped me work it, and I ended up marrying her after dating for about 7 years. We taught, I would probably teach roughly about 35 lessons a week and worked full-time as an engineer and developed a passion for teaching. And everybody always told me that I ought to, try to play professional. I had probably, I had 2 years actually where I only had one round in the 70s, every round was in the 60s. And I loved golf. I loved it dearly. And with the challenges of the business, and then finding a girlfriend, and then going to get married, having children, my career as being a golfer kind of withered on the vine, where my career of being a business began to grow, as I'm sure that there's many people listening that understand exactly what I'm talking about.
So right, exactly.
But life takes over because my passion to play did not override my passion and need to make ends meet. And so in '92, my father and I, we went into business together, and we built a 43-acre teaching complex. So he stayed in the mall for about 3 years after that while I sold my facility. And like I said, we became partners, and we ran that from 1992 all the way up to 2008, and which we sold in 2008. We had one of the largest teaching facilities in Ohio. Like I said, it was a 43-acre teaching complex. In 2004, we were recognized by TaylorMade as the number one account in the United States of America for TaylorMade club sales, including all the Golf Galaxies and the Golf Smiths and
all the great big box stores, we sold more product in 1 year than any of those stores. In 2004, we were in the top five for Callaway sales. In 1999, we were the top sales in the United States of America for Wilson, which was very exciting. We were a hard goods store. We had 17 different major manufacturer fitting centers. We had state-of-the-art heated fitting facility for wintertime driving, and it was a wonderful career. In 92, when my father came to me to ask me about combining efforts and building a big facility, of course, I was pretty much dead set against it. I had a great job as an engineer, making good money, and at the time, I had my own driving range, like I said, miniature golf, volleyball, race car track, and that I built from scratch, and I leased the property. And my father told me at that time, which, you know, sometimes fathers can rub their children the wrong way. At that time, I have nothing. And I said, you know, how can you possibly say I've got nothing? I said, I got money in the bank. I've got a great business. I've got a great future. How can you say I have nothing? And he says, you own nothing. And I said, I don't have to own anything. I mean, you know, I don't have to own a business. And I said, you know, I can lose everything. Dad says, really, what do you have to lose? And I said, Dad, I said, you know, I made over $60,000 last year. I said, I'm 21 years old. What do you mean, what do I got to lose?
Yeah.
And he said, the greatest thing that you're going to gain is a great education. Mm-hmm. And so when Dad and I began, which was his name, Vic's Golf and Teaching Center, in 19, which he had originally had, Vic's Golf Center, and we called it Vic's Golf and Teaching Center and opened that up in 1992, I can honestly say that there was no better or right answer than what Dad had given me that I decided to go for. That and that answer was the greatest thing I would ever have is a great education. And that great education now keeps me in the golf business yet today. And I have opened up in 2008. After we sold the facility, I actually took about 6 months off work. And I opened up a facility at just a gorgeous driving range. It's called the Golf Improvement Center in Medina, Ohio. And I opened up a facility called Greg Jones Golf Academy. And it has just been a wonderful opportunity. And I can honestly say that I've never woke up a day in the past 20 years and went to work. I wake up every day really enjoying everything that I do. And
That's a great, you know, a great point because, you know, I think if you can wake up every day and enjoy what it is that you're doing and have a love and a passion for it, it really isn't a job. And, you know, sometimes, you know, in the early stages of life, we have to, you know, do things that we may not necessarily like or enjoy as much to get our foothold in. But when opportunities, and this is really what your father was getting at, was an opportunity for you to get in and enjoy something that he envisioned that you would enjoy or that he knew that you would enjoy. And it took a little arm twisting, I'm sure, but, you know, eventually you succumbed to the pressure, if you will, and listened to his advice, and obviously it's paid off. And Greg, I want to ask you a question here. I was reading through some of the information. In fact, I'm going to read it out just a little bit here, just some of the opening comments and some of the information you sent me about the Nitro Swing. And then I'm going to have a few questions here for you. And you write here, the Nitro Swing trains the swing, improves fitness, and guarantees to increase distance. And you talk about how your design team was made up of golf instructors and fitness trainers that were inspired by TPI's quest to create distance and a better fit athlete. And, of course, one of the things that you really talk about, and this is what was sort of intriguing about this, there's a lot of different products on the markets that talk about improving golf swings, and there's, you know, products out there that talk about getting players a little more fit and things like that. But this is really a product, if you will, that does and combines both. So what was really sort of the thought process, if you will, behind the development of Nitro Swing?
Well, what happened was, like I said, I've been in the golf business for a great number of years, and over those years, we've had the ability to design many products that have, as we've seen on the market, meaning we designed them years ago, and then we see them come out on the market and go, oh, my gosh, why didn't I come out with that product when we designed it, when we developed it? And so what we took a look at was, is we took a look at what direction golf was going. So in really observing where golf was going, what we've seen was is that club heads were as large as they could possibly get. The design was as great as it's really going to be. Every major manufacturer that comes out with a new club, there's really not much different anymore. When we take a look at the shafts are as good as they're going to get. We try to make them stronger, better, less torque, you know, better flex points, better control. It's just as good as it's going to be. And we take a look at a golf ball. It's as good as it's going to be. And the reason is because the USGA has set down rules and regulations that people have to abide by. And and those rules and regulations really handcuff major manufacturers into exactly what they're able to come up with and no more. And so when we take a look at, you know, illegal golf balls or shafts or clubs, you know, with higher COR, coefficient restitution, you know, spring-like club faces, there's nothing they can do. So what we did was we said, where is golf going? Where can it go? What can it do? And we seen TaylorMade, and they came out with, you know, a performance lab. And we seen Titleist come out with TPI, Titleist Performance Instrument. And we said, oh, my gosh. I mean, this is incredible. This is where we need to go. So my background straight out of high school was I was a big weightlifter. And it was wonderful. I mean, I loved it. One of my best friends, which is really the designer, the man behind the machine, which is Frank Campitelli, which is just an amazing individual, amazing mind, amazing abilities, just an incredible fitness trainer. We took a look at golf, we took a look at fitness, we took a look at the engineering of whatever we wanted to do, and we said, you know, if we come up with something, it has to reach certain criteria, it has to be able to accomplish certain things. And so what golfers do, or golf instructors do, and what made me, I think, very successful in my teaching, is I didn't really look at teaching as a perspective of what teachers do today. I look at teaching as a perspective of training, learning. What is it? How do you train? How do you learn? So what we did is we took a look and we said, where is the golf industry going? Well, it's going to the golfer. So the first thing that we have to do is we have to create something that's going to be able to increase what a golfer can do and accomplish. And we have to be able to increase that easily. So we take a look at golf, as many people say, is, you know, golf is declining. And golf is declining, number one, because it's tough. I mean, it's a tough sport.
Yep.
Number two, you know, when we take a look at every turn that we go, we've got new rules, new regulations, new things that you know, really stifle, I think, the growth and the fun. I mean, what do people want to do? They want to have fun in golf. So in order to have fun, what do we need? We need to give them the chance to have fun. Create illegal balls. Create illegal clubs. Let them hit the ball further. They're not playing in a PGA tournament. But yet, we want everybody that plays golf to actually go by the rules of what the USGA has set down. So, you know, it's just not growing. And lastly, we've got a lot of people, females and males, especially as we get older, that don't want to play golf anymore simply because we've lost so daggone much distance. So what can we do? What is the tool in the toolbox? What's the tool in the toolbox that's going to get me more distance? What's the tool in the toolbox that's going to increase my ability to control the swing path? And what's the tool in the toolbox that's going to increase my ability to control the face angle? And realistically, there was nothing. So there's nothing out there that's going to get me in shape. There's nothing out there that's going to help me control the swing. And there's nothing out there that's going to help me to control the face angle. And what happens is we have all these makeup tools that we try to have help, but none of them really work. Because what we have to do is in order to help, we have to really follow guidelines. So three basics, you know, stages of learning. Now, number one is which to diagnose, two is instruct, and three is develop. And then what you want to do is you want to go to the giant step further than that. You want to build, and you got to build a better swing, and build a better game. So with our kind of thought of what it is that golf is lacking, what the industry is lacking, we said it's lacking a better teaching ability. It's lacking a better ability to gain distance. And it's also lacking, and very much so lacking, an ability to groove a golf swing. And we hear so many times that, you know, to groove a swing, it takes 1,000 to 30,000 repetitions of a correct motion for it to become your natural way of doing something. In the golf industry, we say, well, it really takes 21 days and 10,000 repetitions to replace an old habit with a new one. Well, how many of us, after a lesson, can work 21 days in a row and make that repetition the exact same 10,000 reps to replace an old habit with a new one? And the answer is nobody. Nobody can do that unless you're a skill level of a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, a 5 skill level golfer. I mean, we really can't make those repetitions. So what we set out to do. Go ahead.
Well, what I was going to just jump in there real quick and just to add this, and I think one of the things, one of the mistakes, you alluded to this earlier about with the equipment and things like that, you know, the equipment isn't going to get any better than what it is right now, and I think unfortunately a lot of people, and this is not to knock the manufacturers, but I've been very open about this on my program in the past, is, you know, it doesn't matter what equipment you have in your hand, whether you have the number one driver or the number one golf ball that you're playing, if you're not utilizing that equipment properly, it's not going to improve your game. It will to a certain degree, but you know, if you, in other words, you know, you can have the biggest head driver out there, you can have the number one driver, but if you're not using and utilizing it properly, you're not going to get any better. And I think that the industry has tried to create an illusion, if you will, by saying, well, if you get this such and such driver, if you get this over here, you're going to be a better golfer. And really, the equipment isn't really what needed to change. It's changing how people approach the game and how they're being trained to become better golfers. And then you can put whatever equipment you want in your hand to play and be that better golfer. And I think that the industry is starting to realize that now. And this is what I'm sort of sensing your product is here to do, is your product's here to really train the golfer and make them a better player, as opposed to, you know, sticking a different club in their hand and saying, okay, have at it. Would that be a pretty accurate assumption?
Exactly. That's kind of what I was saying is, you know, taking a look at improving the golf game and improving your ability for motor memory skills was, like I said, 21 days, 10,000 reps to replace an old habit with a new one. And that's what we said that we needed to come up with. So in order to do that, we needed to, number one, replicate the golf swing. We needed something that you could make a free motion, meaning a motion on your own, not something that's going to guide you, but something that you can make a motion on your own. And the only way that you're going to be able to make that motion and really create a motor memory skill is to have some sort of resistance as you're creating that motion. And to be able to do that underneath the elements of, like I said a second ago, underneath the elements of the basic stages of learning, which were, number one, I want to diagnose the problem, I want to instruct, and I want to develop. So when I have somebody on the machine, what I'm looking at and what I tried to develop was a machine that actually showed us what you were doing wrong, gave you the understanding of what to do right, and then gave us the ability to make that motion correctly. And so that was our second criteria, was the five basic elements of training. And that's why I said I wanted to bring training into teaching. And those elements were interaction, feedback, intensity, repetition, and frequency. So interaction we can do on the range. Feedback we can get on the range. Intensity we really can't, because intensity we need some resistance. Repetition,
right.
People say the word repetition. I don't know that half the people understand what the word repetition means. Repetition people think is over and over and over and over and over again. Well, every morning I get up and take a shower. There's 24 hours in between that time. And so the 24 hours in between, there's not much frequency there. It's not like I'm taking a shower every 2 seconds, so there's not much frequency. But what we had to do is we had to have something where you had a lot of frequency. That means if we're on the range and you hit one golf ball every 30 seconds, two golf balls every minute, is that enough frequency? Well, the answer is no, because 30 seconds hitting one golf ball, 5 seconds after you hit the ball, what ends up happening is the feeling of the correct or incorrect swing in which you just experienced begins to decay within that 5 seconds, but the frequency isn't there enough. So we wanted to try to create something that gave us that intensity, repetition, and frequency. And what we came up with was a machine that had to produce the golf swing with resistance. And the resistance was in order to help an individual feel the swing, but also we needed to make sure that we had a way that we could build fitness into golf, because the golf club can only give us 2 to 3 extra yards, if possible, if it's the most
yep.
greatest club in the world and we're hitting it and everything's fine-tuned. It's going to gain 2 to 3 yards. TPI, I think, was on the right track, and what they came out with was, you know, they won't let anybody know how many yards a person actually gains. I mean, I've never been able to read their scientific information that says after a program through TPI, we're going to gain 10 yards, we're going to gain 5 yards. So what
right.
we tried to do, tried to come up with something that we took a look at and said, you know, what are the really the 3 things that an individual golfer really needs? Well, an individual golfer needs, number 1, consistency. Number 2, mm-hmm. of course, we want accuracy. And number 3, we want distance. And the problem with distance is every time people talk about distance and accuracy, they put it together and they say, oh, my gosh, you can't get distance and accuracy at the same time. It's impossible to get distance and accuracy at the same time. That's kind of like telling somebody that it's impossible to lose weight and gain muscle at the same time. We know it's you can lose weight, and you know you can gain muscle at the same time. So, you know, that it's not an impossibility. So what we did is we tried to figure out what we could do to do just that. And we came up, like I say, with the Nitro Swing. And the Nitro Swing is just, it's an incredible piece of equipment. It actually trains the golf swing while at the same time creating better accuracy. And again, while at the same time creating more distance. And I know this is extremely difficult for people to understand, but going through, we can teach on it, or we can work on accuracy on it, or we can do both at the same time. Going through an intense program on distance on the machine, what we've been able to do in a 10-session program, and I know this sounds incredible, and I'm basing my some of my future on selling the Nitro Swing. And so these measurements are straight on. There's no exaggeration. 10-session program, 45 minutes each session. After 10 sessions with females, we've gained an average of 29.7 yards off a driver and an average
wow.
of 39.3 yards off a driver with males. And that's a 10-session program. Now, you know, I know that, you know, when we're putting this out all over the United States. We've sold several of them across the pond, and this Nitro Swing is just an incredible piece of equipment. It's fantastic. And what we went after was something that really gave us the ability to control all of these. Number one, you take a look at consistency. So when we say, mm-hmm. well, how can a machine help build consistency? Well, number one, you got instant feedback, kind of like what I talked about just a little bit ago. That instant
right.
feedback, what we do is we use lasers in the handle, both in the tip and in the butt end of the golf club. So when we take the club actually away from the ball, which is actually a club handle, when we take it away from
right.
the ball, what's happening is we have a laser with a line splitter, and that line splitter actually makes a little line which represents the club face at address
mm-hmm.
position. And we take that back on the proper takeaway line or straight back away from the ball. And as then our hands begin to hinge, we want to make sure that the butt end of the club, which we use a different colored laser, which goes across a tracer board on the bottom, which is purple, and it traces the actual butt into the club to make sure that we're on plane angle. At the top of the machine, we're able to change the settings in making it either a driver or long irons or short irons. And so we're able to change where the plane angle actually is. We're able to maneuver the machine up and down for different heights of individual, whether it's a junior or whether it's a, you know, a 6'9" individual. And so when
right.
we actually take away the lasers, actually show what your swing path is, what your takeaway path is, as well as what the face angle is. So when we talk about being able to get interaction and feedback, so as you take this away, you're able to see whether or not that your takeaway is correct and your plane angle is correct or incorrect when you actually bring the club back. And one of the most important things are, of course, is we're able to see what the face angle is doing. An instructor taking a club to the top is now able to stop an individual and have them hold the club there because there's resistance. And as they bring
yep.
down, we're able to separate the upper and the lower body so that we can get a real understanding of what true lag really means and have them feel what lag really means before they're actually able to swing a club. Doing this and doing it with frequency is allowing the individual to get more permanent results faster than other conventional methods. So we're able to do that one right after the other. I'm able to actually make more swings in 2 minutes on the nitro swing that is 100% correct than an individual can make on the driving range in 1 hour in hitting golf balls. If we look again at that 30 balls per, or one ball every 30 seconds, two balls a minute, then you know, we're looking at being able to create more correct swings with the nitro swing in actually 2 minutes than you are going to be able to do in actually 1 hour on the driving range. So we've really been able to increase the frequency. Taking a look at, like I say, consistency, we're able to change each part of the motion and put you in the correct position. Not that it's going to fixate there, that you are able to put yourself in that position and identify that position simply because of the resistance of the actual nitro swing.
And so, let me just jump in here real quick. You know, you talked about earlier on about, you know, sort of the decline in golf. And I think one of the, and I'm sure you'd probably agree, one of the major reasons, there's two reasons that I think. Part of it is a time factor. People just don't have the time as they once did, you know, some years ago. But also it's out of frustration. People have become frustrated trying to learn the game and try to improve on the game. And even though there's a lot of technology out there and a lot of great, you know, products on the market, a lot of times it's giving them information, but it's not really telling them what they need to know. And one of the things that sort of appealed to me about the nitro swing is the fact that you're getting actual feedback. Now, for instance, I'm a visual person, so for me, you know, I can look at video and I can see things, and because I've played golf much like you have from a very early age, I understand the game and I understand what has to be done, and I've played long enough that I've sort of developed my own way of feeling things. But for a lot of people, especially newcomers to the game that haven't played very, very much, you know, there's a lot of, as I said, a lot of products out there, and I know from being down at the PGA show, I saw a lot of things, and I'm not here to knock anything, but there's a lot of things out there that really don't give people feedback. They give them lots of stats and lots of numbers and things like that, but it doesn't tell people or give people direct feedback on what they should be feeling or where they should be taking the club. It's telling them that, but it's not really giving them a physical feedback. And to me, this is really what your product is doing. It's giving them not only a certain amount of visual, but it's giving them a physical feedback in the golf swing, correct?
Exactly. And one of the things that we actually have wanted to do, and actually in the future would hope to do, is to be able to partner with a TrackMan or a K-Vest, because the greatest thing about those pieces of equipment is they diagnose the problem. And the problem is what they do, but they're an awful expensive piece of equipment to diagnose that problem. So they really don't help us learn the solution. Meaning, what I talked about earlier, I said, the three basic stages of learning, which are diagnose, instruct, and develop. The equipment that's out there does a great job in diagnosing it, but in order to help instruct, it doesn't. To help develop a fix, it really doesn't. It just keeps giving us information. So it relies a lot on the interpretation of the student and the instructor. And what those machines do is they really give the instructor a lot of credibility, because the instructor says, you did this, you did this, you did this. But what we have to do now is we really have to overcome the diagnosis so that we can begin to instruct and develop a better swing. And a student, as you know, we can tell a person what to do during a lesson and tell them the same thing 25 times, and 25 out of 25 times they're just not going to do it right. And they're simply because the feedback they get between their motor skills and their muscle skills are completely different. And so what the nitro swing does is allows us to actually diagnose the problem, instruct on the machine, and then the most incredible thing is develop that new swing, simply because they can see every time they move the handle which would be the club. Every time they move it, they can see whether or not they moved it correct or incorrect. So the feedback is just absolutely incredible. Where the feedback currently is, you watch the ball. We're not sure whether you did it right or wrong. And like you said, a lot of times we have this piece of equipment that diagnoses whether you did it right or wrong. But there is absolutely frequency in that motion, because after you go take a look at it, you say, I did this wrong, you walk right back up to fix the problem, and there's really no immediate feedback so that you can do high-frequency training to create permanent results faster than, like I said, conventional methods. So it just really doesn't exist.
Well, and I think what, you know, and again, I'm not knocking any of the products that are out there, but I think a lot of these things are great from the instructor's standpoint. I mean, it's great to have these products available for the instructors to give them the feedback, and they're able to diagnose the problems, but it really doesn't do anything for the, you know, the potential player, if you will. Now, certainly if it's a two players, they're different kettle of fish, but your average, you know, high handicapper or amateur golfer, you know, they're getting numbers and things thrown at them, but it's still not giving them information they need. It's as I said, they're great tools, and I'm not knocking them, because I think TrackMan and some of the others out there are fantastic products.
Yeah,
but they're really, but they're tools for the instructors, really. When you think about it, it's to give them the information for them to diagnose what the problems are, and then now they have to take and articulate those problems and create a solution for the players. And this is really where the NitroSwing can come in, as you said, sort of marry. Once they diagnose the problem, you can now use the NitroSwing really to be able to now transfer that to the player.
You're absolutely right. And like I said, I absolutely love I love the TrackMan. I love the K-Vest. I love these pieces of equipment out there. I think they're absolutely fantastic, but I think that they're very limited and how they're going to teach a golfer. Let me kind of tell you something that we've done twice now. And we teach so many lessons. I teach an average of 70 lessons a week right now. What we did was my partner Frank is a fitness trainer, and he's got more degrees and stuff than you can shake a stick at. And we came up with the actual NitroSwing. We developed, designed, and built it. We took a second back, and we said, oh, my gosh, I can't believe that what we've got here has been created. Frank, I mean, this is so unbelievable that there's nothing ever been like this in golf. There's nothing ever that's going to allow anybody to feel and build and develop a golf swing faster, better than what the NitroSwing can possibly do. And so at that time, I said to Frank, you know, I know that you're busy. Let me build a little addition on just for the NitroSwing. And let's run it for a year. Let's do testing for a year's time, and let's see what we get. Well, Frank, working part-time last year, because the product's brand new, working part-time last year, did over $34,000 in lessons. Frank's not a golfer. He's a fitness trainer. If Frank went out and played, golf, he's going to shoot in the mid to upper 40s. I mean, that's what he does. But what happened was, is after developing this, 2.5 to 3 years after developing it, then we decided a year ago to do this. And we decided that because a lot of people are listening. You can look this up. Frank Campitelli, he's qualified the last two years in a row for the Remax World Long Drive Championship. His longest drive now is over 400 yards.
Wow.
And I want you to understand, when Frank started golf at age 40, six years ago, when I first met him and first seen Frank hitting golf balls, he was hitting the driver 160 to 180 yards, as good as he could do it. And then the best Frank could do was around 250 yards. And now Frank's longest drive is over 400 yards. Now, there's nobody out there in the long drive industry that doesn't know Frank. And there's nobody out there that doesn't know him as a swing trainer. We're not looking to have the next big long drive champion come out with a nitro swing trainer. What we're looking for is exactly what we said earlier. We're looking for that golfer out there that wants to improve their distance, improve their accuracy, improve their consistency. We're looking at that golfer. Now, what does this product do? What does this product do for the instructor? Well, the one thing is the three things that the instructor wants. Number one is they want better results. Number two, they want more clients. And number three, they want increased revenue. So if we have a machine that's going to produce results, then we're going to get clients, which is going to result in increased revenue. And, you know, a lot of times we're asked, well, how does the nitro swing actually increase distance? Well, again, what I said earlier was when we started taking a look at what we wanted to do was first we wanted to build, you know, three stages of learning, diagnose, instruct, and develop, and then go that giant step further and build a better swing. Second, we needed to do the five basic stages of learning, which were to diagnose, instruct, develop, interaction, feedback, and
interaction, feedback. Yeah.
Right. So that's what we needed to be able to get. And then third, we wanted to make sure that we were able to increase club head speed. So how are we able to do that? Well, number one, when we watch other people doing this, they're throwing medicine balls into walls and they're holding, you know, weights up in the air and they're thinking that this is simulating a golf swing. Well, there's only one thing that's going to simulate a golf swing, and that's the actual athletic motion. So the movement pattern, in order to increase club head speed, has to be replicated. The movement pattern must be similar to the actual athletic motion. If it's not, then we're not going to be able to build a faster, quicker, better swing. We're going to go roundabout. And people say, well, what do you really mean about that? Well, let's just kind of take it this way. If you wanted to work on your bench press today, don't go do squats. Walk over and do your bench press. And the reason is if we do squats, yes, we can get stronger. Yes, our back, our body, everything can get stronger. But it's going to be so minimal on what we can do to increase distance or increase muscle mass on the bench press. It's not going to be anything. So if we want to actually work on increasing club head speed, the movement pattern, it's got to be similar to the actual athletic motion. It's got to be a tilted access rotational swing. That's what it has to be. Second, we want to work on contraction velocity. Contraction velocity simply means it must be similar to the actual event. The actual event for weightlifting, if I lift heavy weights, I'm going to lift slow. But for golf, I want a fast motion. So contraction velocity must be similar to the event. Fast for golf, slow for weights. Contraction force. Contraction force simply means it has to be done with resistance. It must be higher than the actual event. So to help you understand that, if you wanted to start trying to do 50 push-ups, and at the end of the month your goal was to increase to do 50 push-ups, but today you can only do 7. And every day for the next 30 days you only did 7 push-ups a day, how could you ever expect to increase to 50? We just couldn't. So what we have to be able to do is we have to be able to increase the resistance, or we must be higher than the actual event. So when you actually swing a club, no matter how many times you swing it, if you're not increasing the resistance on the swing and swinging it fast, then you're not going to be able to increase club head speed. Now, a lot of people say, well, can I swing one of those heavy-weighted clubs? Yeah, that's great. Swing one of those heavy-weighted clubs. When you get down towards the impact area, the only thing everybody does is decelerate so it doesn't haul off and hit them in the back. So now you're training yourself to decelerate into a golf shot. And we can't. We have to accelerate through the golf shot. We have to be able to make sure that we're accelerating through with high speed, with more resistance, and be able to change and increase that resistance week after week after week after week so we can get stronger, 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 stronger. And lastly, the contraction type needs to be imitated. And what we're really talking about is muscle contractions. Whether it's concentric, eccentric, or isometric motions, we need to make sure that the muscles are working in the same way as a golf swing works. And if we're trying to lift weights, it's going to change. We need to work the fast twitch muscles. We need to work them in the sequence and the firing of what they're doing during a golf swing. So we need to actually be able to do that in order to increase club head speed. And when we talk about golfers or golf instructors wanting better results, when they take a look at golfers today in a golfer comes up and says, you know, I would really like to hit the ball further. I'd like to increase my – the instructor kind of taps them on the back because they have no tools in the toolbox to help do that and say, you know, let's work on our accuracy, improve our swing, and we'll increase distance. There's no doubt in that we wouldn't. But the golfer would like to increase distance not with just a driver, but a golfer wants to increase distance with all clubs. And if I increase my swing and my abilities, of course I'm going to increase distance. But, you know, maybe perhaps I just really want to come in and increase distance. We talked a second ago about, you know, you said what are one of the two reasons why that, you know, golfers, that golf is kind of dying. Number one, it takes so long to play. Well, let's fix that problem by just making 3 6-hole courses. You can play six, you can play nine, you can play 12, you can play 18. So, you know, it gives the ability to be able to you know, play golf in less time. I mean, it would be great to play in a six-hole league. It'd be great to go out and just play six holes. The other thing is what you said as well was, you know, golf's not an easy sport. I mean, it's tough to learn. So we need to find a better way to teach. And so one of the things that when you said that, the first thing that came to my mind was that we've done this twice now, is we've taken a right-handed golfer and work with them for 5 straight days, just making sure the first time wasn't a fluke. And before we began to work with them, we had them swing left-handed, and they couldn't play golf left-handed. So what we did is we trained them on the nitro swing for 5 straight days, did 5 individual lessons for 45 minutes, 5 days in a row, and at the end of 5 days, without exaggeration, they could hit the ball left-handed and hit it well. Hit the ball well left-handed by training on the nitro swing, simply because it follows the training and teaching elements so that we can build a better golf swing. And so it's a very, very unique piece of equipment. And the greatest thing that we found is that we're not looking at trying to get this in the hands of the instructor to say, I want you to use this just to enhance your teaching ability on the current students that you have. What we're looking at is putting this in the instructor's hands so that they actually build a new business, really attract customers which they once had or never had, customers that they'll never have, because a customer may say, you know, I'm really not interested in a golf lesson, but I would be interested in gaining more distance. An older person might say, you know, I'm really not interested in getting this golf lesson, but I don't play golf anymore because I'm so embarrassed of how short I hit the ball. So I would like to really gain some clubhead speed. I'd really like to be able to do this. And the nitro swing, like I say, for testing now for the last year, it absolutely works. We actually have in Medina, we have in surrounding areas, Akron areas, we actually have a golf tech, which is an amazing facility. It's got a fantastic owner, Nick Paez, which was 2 years ago, which he was the PGA Teacher of the Year. And Nick has our nitro swing in his golf tech facility. Golf tech, when we take a look at what tech stands for, you know what, for the life of me, I just can't remember what the E is, but teaching. And last is conditioning. And right now, if we look at all the facilities that are out there, there's really nothing in them that are about conditioning. We take a look at many of the country clubs now trying to pull new members by adding fitness facilities. If you're wanting a fitness facility, no fitness facility would be complete without the nitro swing trainer. No gym is complete without the nitro swing trainer. And no teaching is complete without the nitro swing trainer, due to the fact the way that it teaches the golf game faster, creates better results, and unbelievably changes swing path and face angle so that a person owns it overnight and increases distance like nothing in the industry has ever been able to accomplish. And it's just been an exciting ride.
Greg, as we're getting close here to having to wrap up here, how can, if they want to get more information on the Nitro Swing Trainer, first off, where can they go? Obviously, I know you have a website, and you also have some YouTube videos as well that kind of show it in motion, how it works. I know you've done some yourself, and then you have some others. Let the audience know how they can get more information on the Nitro Swing Trainer, and also particularly some of the teaching pros out there, if they're interested in learning more, where they can go to get that information.
Well, the Nitro Swing, to kind of look that up on YouTube, you know, we've got nitroswing.com, our page, but actually just go on YouTube and just type in the Nitro Swing. There's a new YouTube video that I just put up. It's just a couple minutes long, and it teaches you know, how an instructor would really be able to increase their income. You know, we take a look at the Nitro Swing. If you're really interested in getting some more information and increasing your income, which kind of what I did, like I said, is, you know, mm-hmm. I had Frank come in and teach, and the first year he made $34,000. That's not the only one. My other instructor, Dan, he made about $27,000 on the machine, and he taught part-time on the machine as well. So what happens is I kind of leave the teaching without stepping on their toes. I leave the teaching of the Nitro Swing to them. But what we've been able to see is if you just did 10 students in a year's time, we charge $50 a lesson, and the sessions are, you know, 10 lessons, $500. 10 students is $5,000. If you're doing 10 students in a year's time, you basically pay for your piece of equipment. If you're only doing 10 lessons in a year's time, you know what? You need to do more. I do a little over 1,000 lessons a year. And, you know, if you just did 110 lessons a year at $50 a session, you're looking at $55,000. And that's very easy to do. 80 students in a year's time is $40,000. You know, we find that it's actually something to where, you know, I suggest that you're having something that you've never offered before. You're having something that, especially in the colder climates in which I live in, Ohio.
Right.
I put together one of the best winter teaching training programs that I think that you could have. And in that winter boot camp that we put together this year, we were busier in that boot camp this winter than we are in the summertime. I mean, it was absolutely fantastic. And what we were able to do is reach out and touch people, which we're still reaping the benefits of today. We were able to reach out and touch many high schools, many colleges, and as well senior. We reached out to some of the lady leagues. We weren't successful, but some of the senior organizations, we were very successful. And what I take a look at is this product is basically 3 to 4 phases. Number one is for the golf instructor. Number two is for the college mm-hmm. coach. Those college coaches that really want to improve the games of their students and really make themselves a place on the map, the people that hit the ball the furthest are the people that are going to win the tournaments. People that hit the ball the straightest, the most consistent, are going to win the tournaments. So if we can add consistency, accuracy, and distance, we're going to win tournaments. So we take a look at, like I say, the college coach, and last, the fitness trainer. What we're also trying to do is take a look at building a reputation in with rehab centers. So for mm-hmm. people that have had strokes, people that have had major injuries, being able to develop a golf swing and get back into the game, this is a perfect opportunity to be able to do that. And if you're interested in the Nitro Swing, you can give me a call at 567-241-3746, or you can reach out. You can email me to gregthegolfguy@gmail.com. So I've had some of you might recognize that, gregthegolfguy@gmail.com. I've had a couple different TV shows from time to time, and been in the business now, like I say, for a long time, over 30 years. I can't believe I'm only 45. I know. I mean, you just keep getting older, right? I just hate it.
That's right.
But, right?
Yeah,
but, yeah,
I got you. I know.
I have, I was going to say, you know, I have the website, Greg Jones Golf Academy. You can take a look and get some stuff off that, or you can go to GregTheGolfGuy.com. You can also go to Nitro Swing Trainer or the NitroSwing.com. You can go to any one of those and you know, get a hold of me and reach out, and we can definitely talk about the Nitro Swing and see about how we get you set up for it. We're looking for a lot of different things with the Nitro Swing. We're looking for different distributors, mm-hmm. salesmen, things like that. We've been growing so fast that I think that the more we're in the industry, the better and the bigger it's going to be.
We're actually looking at signing some big names right now, which are great. We're working with 4U Management, which is a big management company for many of the major players out there, and working with Daryl Kratzer, which is 4U Management. He's just an incredible individual, and 4U Management is an incredible company. He handles Ben Crane as well as Lee Jansen. Not saying that we signed any of those guys. I'm just giving you an idea who's handling. Who we're trying to sign, some of those guys, of course, all red, many of those guys, and what a great outfit they are. But, you know, that's kind of where we would like to go. We'd like to be able to meet some of the guys, and we'd like to get some big-name guys on board, which we haven't tried yet. So it's not that we're unsuccessful. We just haven't reached out to anybody yet.
I don't think it's going to take very long. And, you know, I've familiarized myself with the product and that through some of the video and reading some of the information that you've sent me. And I definitely think it's going to help. And I think anything that we can do to help grow this game, because it has been in decline. And it's not that golf isn't a great game, but it's just that we need to find, you know, newer and more inventive ways of re-engaging people and making it more fun, as you said. And I think, you know, for a while there, the industry seemed to be going in a different direction. I think they're starting to finally realize that in order to, you know, make it a sport that people want to be more engaged in, they have to make it fun again and not, you know, overcomplicated. And I think, you know, your Nitro Swing Trainer is something that can help accomplish that. So I'm glad that you're able to come on tonight, Greg, and I want to thank you for being my guest this evening and discussing some of the features and obviously benefits of the Nitro Swing Trainer. And I will certainly do whatever I can on my end to help promote it, and you and I will talk at a later point, but I'll get some information from you on that, and I'll get it up on my website so that my listeners and viewers can get some further information as well. But, Greg, I want to thank you for coming on, as I said, tonight, and being a guest on Golf Talk Live. I appreciate all the insight and information that you gave us on the Nitro Swing Trainer. And just one more time, very quickly, Greg, if you could just read out the information on where they can get a hold of you and where they can get more information on the Nitro Swing.
Sure, that's Greg Jones. You can look at the nitroswing.com, mm-hmm. or you can actually go on a couple different of my websites, the Greg Jones Golf Academy, or, in fact, GregTheGolfGuy.com. Either one of those, you can give me a call direct at 567-241-3746, or you can email me at GregTheGolfGuy@gmail.com. That's GregTheGolfGuy@gmail.com. And you know, I just love golf, and I think I love it as much as most enthusiasts out there. I think this Nitro Swing Trainer is taking golf in a new direction and is going to be able to develop golf swings faster and better. And the most important thing is, you know, when I go to any demo day, I go to any fun event, one thing everybody likes to do is smash drivers and hit them as long as they can, as hard as they can. Well, it would be great if we had a machine that allowed us to swing harder, swing faster, swing more often, and hit them straighter. And I think that's exactly
that's right.
what we got with it.
Exactly, and I'm sure in reflection you're glad that you listened to your father's advice. I'm quite certain of that by now. But Greg, again, thank you very much for reaching out to me and coming on the program. I like to share, you know, some interesting topics and things like that here on Golf Talk Live, and I always get lots of great feedback, and I know I'll get some great feedback on this as well. And I appreciate you coming on the program tonight, and I'll definitely be in touch with you and get some more information from you and get that up on my website and that. But Greg, have a great evening, and thank you very much for sharing the Nitro Swing with my audience here on Golf Talk Live.
Thank you very much, Ted, and everybody listening. I sure appreciate you, and thank you, and let's keep growing this golf game.
Sounds good. All right, you have a great evening and have a great weekend.
Yes, sir, you too. Bye-bye.
All right, thanks. Bye-bye. Okay, just a quick moment here just to wrap up very quickly. I want to thank my Coach's Corner panel tonight, Michael Wheeler and, of course, Brad Redding for stepping up and giving another great Coach's Corner segment tonight. And obviously, I want to thank my special guest, Greg Jones, the golf guy, of course, and the Academy Director of the Nitro Swing Trainer. Thanks, Greg, for coming up and sharing that. It is, I believe, a great product, and I think it's really going to help a lot of golfers out there that struggle with their game. And I know if you want to help improve and grow this game, we have to work together as a team and bring to the forefront some great products like the Nitro Swing. So, Greg, thanks for coming on Golf Talk Live and sharing that this evening. And, again, if you want to get more information, you can go to nitroswing.com and get that information. But I want to take this time to thank, of course, the most important people, and that is all of the listeners worldwide for faithfully tuning into Golf Talk Live each week. I certainly enjoy and get a lot of great and pleasure myself for having you listening to the program each and every week, and for all of the great, talented coaches and teacher professionals and entrepreneurs that stop by here and chat with me. And it's through their participation and their guest appearances that have helped make Golf Talk Live a first-class show. So I want to give a special thank you to all of those. And also to some of the sponsors and supporters of the show, Mr. Jonathan Laird of South Coast Golf Guide, who always has some great things to say about the program. Thank you, Jonathan, for all of your continued support. And, of course, Meredith Kirk of Meredith Kirk Golf and also Endless Golf, Myrtle Beach Magazine. And, of course, she was the 2014 Mrs. South Carolina, soon to be getting involved with her next pageant, which is going to be Mrs. USA. So that's coming up, I believe, in August. So good luck in that endeavor as well. And obviously Meredith is a top-notch instructor in golf and continues to help grow the game, particularly at the junior level. But thank you, Meredith, for your continued support. And Nikki and Tiffany Litherland, of course, for spreading the word. Some great people in the golf business that I've met through different social media, and they're always a big supporter of the program as well. Thank you, guys. And, of course, Mr. Bernie Pinder of Ontic Golf, a great line of custom-designed putters. Mr. Bernie Pinder, thank you very much for your continued support. And, of course, my good buddy across the pond, as they say, Peter Doyle of Doyle Golf Solutions over in Ireland. I want to take this opportunity to thank him as well. But thanks, guys, for tuning in. And don't forget to tune in next Tuesday for the other program that I'm involved with of course, my co-host, LPGA professional Cindy Miller, on the Women of Golf. That's every Tuesday at 9 a.m. here on blogtalkradio.com. Instead of typing in Golf Talk Live on Tuesday morning, you type in Women of Golf at the search key on blogtalkradio.com. And that comes on every Tuesday at 9 a.m. Eastern Time. That's 9 a.m. Eastern Time. So don't forget to tune into the Women of Golf here on the Blog Talk Radio Network. And obviously every Thursday evening at 6 p.m. Central Time, you can find me right here hosting by myself on Golf Talk Live. And, of course, we'll have another exciting and great Coach's Corner next week and another guest to follow as well. So thanks, guys. Have a great weekend, everybody, and I will see you back here Thursday, 6 p.m. Central Time, right here on Golf Talk Live. God bless, and thanks. Have a great weekend, everybody.